Maybe we want to slap the table.
Oh yeah, sorry. Very good, very good. Yes, we have to go. 1, 2, 3. Hurrah, we start. 3, 2, 1. Yes, this is never at the same moment, but it only goes about the peak. So finally, we start this episode, ladies and gentlemen. We are going to talk about how can we radically change the mobility within the municipality of Amsterdam. My name is Geert Kloppenburg. The name of the podcast is the Metropolitan Mobility Podcast. And how can we keep metropolitan areas accessible? And I'm doing this podcast with my favorite sidekick, Karin ten Hage. She has worked in this field for a very, very, very long time already in logistics, worked for TNT and sustainability, worked for many different companies, logistic mobility. Have I said everything right so far, above from that we know each other already 15 years? Is this a proper introduction, Karin?
Well, it's definitely a proper introduction. And what I think I've never revealed before is that my particular interest goes out to changing the behavior of people. So you mentioned a lot of logistics and e-commerce, etc. But my real, real deep down focus is always on people.
Okay, so I learn every day. Again, now I did this special series of interviews already with you about mobility as a service. And in your words, what are we actually looking for or trying to ask to different persons in this series of interviews?
Well, I think with this quest to find a radical redesign, we're trying to understand how, as a municipality, we can influence the digital domain to actually get to that radical redesign. And we're talking a lot about digital highways or digital infrastructure, et cetera, but what is it really all about? And I think in today's podcast, we're going to zoom in onto something more specific, which is inclusive mobility. And I have this question, this is sort of a nagging question in the back of my mind, is if we're designing all these new sort of really technical solutions or app-driven solutions, are we not super biased and only designing for people that look and talk and think like us? So digitally illiterate, high income, high education, etc., etc. Are we missing out on an important subset of society?
White men like me, middle-aged, and like your women, but like thinking out of your own bubble.
I didn't want to make it as specific, but yeah, are we designing only for Geert Kloppenburg?
That's or the most are important thing people? Anyway. But let's go to our guest, because Sofia Rangordas, and I've probably pronounced it wrong for the hundreds of times. Are you there already now with all your recording stuff from up north in Holland, in Groningen? Are you there?
I am. Hi, Geert. Hi, Karin. Thanks for having me.
Hi, Sofia.
Oh, Karin, can you give a proper introduction for our professor, because then she doesn't have to do it herself, because she's got a CV that's quite long. So let's us talk about it and then she can say what we forgot.
Yeah, I'm actually super excited that you're here, Sofia. I mean, you've got an impressive career. You're currently a professor of European and Comparative Public Law in Groningen, as Geert just said, at the University of Groningen. And I'm so interested in your specific focus, because you actually look into the relationship between the public and the private actors when it comes to the implementation of disruptive technology. And you've published on smart cities, on sharing economy. So all the stuff that we are actually looking into, you have looked into. And I actually saw that your agenda or your research agenda for the coming years will be about digital exclusion. So that is just spot on of what we're going to be talking about today. So super glad you're here.
Well, thanks for having me. I think you really covered it all, because I'm interested in digital exclusion. And I really think that it is important, because most people only talk about law and technology from the privacy side, but they really forget the human side of technology. And that's what I'm really trying to approach with my research.
What does including mean for you? You are the professor here, so we are just talking about it. What would your definition be?
Including means that, just like Karin was saying, everyone, like every citizen, feels that there is a place for them. So regardless of their differences, regardless of their preferences, there is a way for them to find, for example, mobility, find a way to have access to transportation or to pedestrian infrastructure That is what inclusiveness is. And when we talk about inclusive mobility, many people think, well, it's only about for people that have disabilities. No, it's not. There are a lot of people who don't feel included because they actually don't have the income to spend on public transportation because they don't feel like cycling. And people in the Netherlands will tell them, no, in the Netherlands, we cycle. So if you want to live here, you also have to cycle. I'm sorry, but that is not really inclusive. That is imposing your values on other people. And a society which wants to be democratic should not only impose values. You should also like have an eye for different values and different preferences.
What's the problem having that bias?
Well, we see that research on mobility of citizens with a migrant background. So many of them, for example, are Dutch. The citizens actually move less and have fewer job opportunities than native Dutch citizens who have more mobility. Very often because they don't feel comfortable cycling, because they have less income to spend, but also because they just don't feel like they can really use certain apps. So all these mobility as service is something totally unknown for them. So it really has the effect that they have less mobility, so less opportunities when it comes to education, jobs, and social activities as well.
Let's say in my language, do you want to say that I just read in the newspaper at Parool, that's a local paper in Amsterdam, it says 25% of the children, they were not able or not capable of cycling. And I was, with my bias, totally surprised because I thought to myself, 99% of the children learn to cycle straight away. Is that like my bias, that I'm too stupid or I don't see that? Is that what you mean?
I'll give you like an example. I learned to cycle when I was 27 years old. Yeah, 27. And everyone said, it's because you're Portuguese, because you grew up in a country where no one cycles to work. That's not true.
That is the problem, because you're Portuguese.
No, well, it's not. Everyone can cycle in Portugal because everyone learns as a kid. But I didn't have a father to teach me. Yeah. So in that sense, you know, there are so many reasons why people don't cycle. Also, in many places, like, parents will not have the time to teach their children. I mean, of course, you will do it because it's in your culture. But in many migrant cultures, bicycles have a low status. So why would you actually teach your kid to use a low status vehicle? You can just better give money to your kid when he or she becomes 18 to get a driver's license, which many Dutch people don't have.
And how hot is that? Yeah, coming current. Yep.
No, I'm just trying to summarize. So I hear you mention different barriers or reasons for exclusion. So I think the last one you mentioned is the cultural one, how it's looked upon, whether or not you're cycling. I heard you mention the financial one. You can't afford certain modes of transportation, and you mentioned the physical or mental disability one. But I also read in your paper about the digital exclusion. So how do we actually have figures on how many people we exclude through these numbers of reasons?
So in my paper on the right to mobility, I discuss many of these problems. And one of the statistics that I use is actually from the Central Bureau for Statistics, mm-hmm. which has done research on transport poverty. And they have found that, for example, in Heerlen, 80% of the population suffers from transport poverty, 18%. It's quite high for the Netherlands, I would say. In Utrecht, it's lower, it's 1.9. I actually think it's probably more. But it is about 20% in Western countries. So 20% of population in Western countries is actually transport poor, which is quite a lot if you think of it. Because even with digital exclusion or with digital services, these people are still not being served. And also because they don't have digital literacy to use them.
Is that digital literacy also part of that particular research that you're mentioning?
If I recall well, the Central Bureau for Statistics has developed an index that takes into account different variables. Low income literacy is one of them. But they don't account for digital literacy specifically because the impact of digital literacy on mobility is actually not very well researched so far.
Mm.
And is it like, in my words, I always like to go to the street or to my own situation. The 25% of the cycling was a very, very clear example. But let's say to my mom, she's 73. She's just learned to use her iPhone and she's white, high educated. But if you like say people who are 60, 70, black, white, you see that they've got so much difficulty using the apps? Or do you mean the apps and all these things are not designed for them? Or do you say, no, your question is even wrong. They don't even see the people who have to use it. They don't know what they want.
I would say all of it, basically.
Okay, I'll ask three questions in a row.
Yeah, so one of the things that I have written on my papers on public and private values is that you really see that companies, so private tech that designs these applications, they really focus on, you know, profit making, but they also have their own private interests that are taken into account. They don't take into account the public interest of inclusiveness. So they don't take into account motivations of, for example, the elderly, unless it is an application designed for the elderly. For example, applications for Alzheimer's, they really take into account this. So you have mobility applications for Alzheimer's that really are designed in very simple terms, and they can really help the elderly find their way home, for example, if they get lost. That is fine, but it's a specific, more socially oriented kind of app.
So we're now talking definition and problem. And I think you gave quite a clear definition of what can actually cause the exclusion of certain groups of people from decent mobility and also what it results in. So less access to social activity, to the services that a city offers, to maybe even healthcare and education and jobs. And I was wondering, I mean, is this on the global agenda?
In France, it's definitely on the agenda. For example, Estonia has in Tallinn free public transportation for residents. In Portugal, in a small city next to Lisbon, Cascais, they have also introduced this year a free public transportation. So in some cities you see it, but I won't say it's on the global agenda. That is, unfortunately, it's not. But if you look at the riots in Santiago, in Tehran, you see that, and also even the Gilets Jaunes in France, they were all caused by transport poverty. People could not afford the price of fuel, or they could not afford the price of public transportation. So it's not, but it should be on the global agenda.
How big is the problem? What kind of statistics are out there? Do you know of any other statistics, Sophia?
There are some studies at local level, but they are not very thorough. So the most thorough study that I have seen is actually from Finland. And that one really shows that there are problems, and that 20% of the population in Helsinki does not have proper access. There are also some studies from the European Energy Fuel Agency. Actually, I don't know exactly the name, but I can definitely provide for the link. And they actually calculate the impact of public transportation, or just transportation in general, on a household income. So that those statistics exist. And again, it really varies depending on the country. So I would say that in Hungary, for example, 30% of the population, 40, have problems paying for transportation. In the Netherlands or Sweden, is much less. So it really varies. But there are some statistics in general. But I would say that they focus mostly on the impacts of the cost of transportation on household income.
Ah, yeah, okay. So which percentage of your income is actually dedicated to transport or should be dedicated?
Exactly. Oh, Karen, can I react on that too? I saw a couple of papers in the south of Rotterdam. They had a specific area there. And I did an interview, a podcast interview with Roger Demkes. And he talked about this called vervoersarmoede. I think it's just poverty.
Transport
poverty. And they were doing these first researches on it. So it was not much what I've seen so far. But he says he was also surprised, just as the professor was saying, that it was so much bigger in Rotterdam than he thought. Then my idea was, maybe you haven't studied it yet, but I'm always like, okay, I'm talking to how is it for my mother, but how is it for the people in Almere? Who are we talking about? I want to more visualize the person. Is it the person living in far west? Who do you think are we talking about? Can you give us, have you got, describe them?
We're talking about usually women with migrant backgrounds, and actually with migrant backgrounds, also men can be affected. Young people are very often affected by transport poverty. And not only people, young people living in rural areas, but also within cities. You see that, I think Roger Demke also mentioned that in the podcast, that people from Rotterdam South never cross the bridge. They're always there. They never go to the city center of Rotterdam because it's just too expensive to take the tram, or they don't feel like, you know, like cycling, or they can't. So actually, I would say it's usually people with a migrant background living in suburbs, which are usually not as wealthy. You know, people that work in low paid jobs, I would say. So
is it also very much 24 hour work? Like we used to work, Karel and me worked at, I worked in TNT in a parcel.
Sorting in a night shift.
In a night shift. So that, yeah, there were a lot of people there. And then they had to use a car, and they always came by a very old car at 3 o'clock at night because the public transport was not running. Let's say this was the south of Utrecht, but there's also one very big sorting center in Amsterdam west side in the harbor. Is that what you mean? And that's why they go in a riot if they put up the prices for gasoline?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, there are locations, like many factories are located really in the middle of nowhere. And if you have public transportation, it will only be for working hours. So that really means that if there are shifts, people will have to have a driving license. And maybe a man will actually dare to go at 3 o'clock in the morning to start a shift. But would a woman do that? I'm not sure. So many of these people who actually don't have access to proper transportation, they can't accept certain jobs. And now with the economic crisis will probably start with the corona situation, there will be probably jobs like at sorting centers, which will only be limited or reserved for people that have access to private transportation.
But this is interesting. So this is a particular group that we're trying to describe. And while we're describing, I'm getting a little bit anxious because I'm thinking, we are talking about these people that we don't know. We don't live their lives. We don't have them in our podcast. We cannot ask them how they experience it, how big the problem is, how they perceive it, etc. And I'm just starting to wonder that maybe even our listeners, who are also experts, could help us sort of put together this almost pie chart of different groups and the different numbers, because I've read reports on mental and physical disability transportation or people with a mental or physical disability, but that excludes this group. So it's like there's all siloed figures, but who has the overview of the numbers of the different groups, and have we actually talked to them to understand, okay, what is it that you need?
Okay, Karen, but then I come up with maybe a difficult question. How does a researcher, a professor, solve this problem trying to get to know what their demands are? How do you do that? How do you try to get that data, interviews? How do you work on that?
I mean, I'm a lawyer, so for me, I would say that what interests me is whether this is having an impact on their rights. That is how I would approach it. I would first see, well, is this having an impact on their right to work, for example? That's how I would first frame it. A right-based approach to work is also what I do in my paper. But if you would be a social scientist in a broader sense, you would have to conduct interviews, perhaps a survey, and actually you probably have to do door-to-door interviews to really ask people, when have you been outside of your neighborhood? Have you tried to apply to a better paying job outside of Rotterdam South? And that would be the best way to really understand how these people feel. But I have the feeling that a lot of public bodies do not want to solve the problem, not only because it affects like 20% at the worst scenario population, but also because they associate it with poverty in general. So they think if they are able to get their finance on track, then they can actually be mobile. And that's not totally true. Transport poverty is much more complex than just low income.
And it seems like there is a cause and effect. So how are you going to get your finances in order if you don't have access to mobility? So
yeah exactly. I mean, it is basically so multidimensional and so circular that you need to actually get the right transport or the right mobility first. And I mean, I think in my paper, I also refer to mobility justice, which is a concept that really refers to having access to mobility on equitable terms, which means that if you need to work at a sorting center at night, you might need to have access to private transportation. That's not a luxury. But I mean, in many cases, Social Security might see owning a car as a luxury. So you wouldn't have maybe the right to have benefits if you own a certain kind of car. This has been discussed, for example, in Australia in a case. And I think it's important to see what do these people need to get out of the circle of poverty. And mobility justice is really about making sure that you treat citizens equally by taking into account their needs, their motivations, and also like their ambitions. And that is quite complex to actually implement in practice.
Yeah, so we've been talking a lot about the problem, but do you know of any current solutions that are being tested?
There are some projects out there. So the most famous at the moment is called Universal Basic Mobility, which basically seeks to provide free public transportation to everyone. So this is what Tallinn has been working with, as well as some cities in France, like, for example, Dijon, if I'm not mistaken, middle-sized cities in France, I would say, and also Qashqai's in Lisbon. And in the US, I've read quite a lot that there are some think tanks that really want to push forward the idea of universal basic mobility. So many of the pilots that exist are actually on this level. Mm-hmm. I've also seen something interesting that I think we should have more of, and that is social transportation. And basically these organizations, mostly out of, you know, just charity purposes, that actually organize public and private transportation, usually like vans or just drivers, to actually transport people that need to go to a medical appointment, for example. And this doesn't sound very innovative, but actually it can really help people with migrant backgrounds that, especially the elderly, that need to go to medical appointments and don't know really how to go, or actually can't really afford public transportation.
So we're talking about this, and then suddenly I go back into my old thinking and I think to myself, what is Karen or this professor complaining about? We've got this special mobility for school person. We've got public transport. We've got this all organized. So why is there such a big gap? Why is this suddenly such a big thing? We've got this all organized. What's the problem?
This is a question that many policymakers actually have. And that's why transport poverty is not on the agenda. Because there are already a lot of schemes. So, for example, with health insurance, you could actually order a taxi to go to medical treatment, for example. Schools indeed have transportation.
Yeah, you get the discounts if you're over 65 to go to public transport and you pay hardly nothing.
Absolutely. You have all that. But the thing is, you still see that many citizens with migrant backgrounds still don't take the bus or the tram that often. Because even if you pay hardly nothing, the question is, how much is the hardly nothing going to impact the household income? What else cannot be done because of that? And these children that really have access to public transportation, they have it between their house and the school probably, but in the weekend, they can't go anywhere. So for example, in England, there has been research showing that many children never leave certain areas. They live close to Bristol, but they never go to Bristol. Because the school transportation does not cover like social, social activities. And for a child, there's nothing worse than not being able to really go out with a friend, not being able to go on a trip. And that is also transport poverty. As a lawyer, what I really see is that the right to public transportation is not seen as, or let's put it that way, public transportation is not seen as an essential service. At the same level, like water or gas or anything else, right? So that is important. And that's the reason why it has not been as high up on the agenda when it comes to protection of people, making sure that people are equally treated. I think that's an important point. If we wanted to redesign public and private transportation to make sure that everyone has access to it, I think we need to first rethink the relationship between public and private actors in the mobility sector. So what I have been writing about on for a couple of years, because mobility as a service provides more mobility options to those that already have a lot of options. People that can mm-hmm. afford the car, the train, everything. They just need to combine it better. So the data will allow them to actually be more efficient. And that is fine. But the thing is, we need to actually design also mobility as a service for those that have lower digital literacy, that might be a little bit more skeptical when it comes to engaging with technology, and also those who cannot afford always a train. The train is actually quite expensive for some group of people. So we need to actually come up with subsidies, for example. And this costs money. And that's why redesigning for everyone is quite unaffordable, because it will cost quite a lot of money. So subsidies, not only for people above 65, but also for others. So for people with low income, I think that would really help quite a lot. But also think more of shared forms of private transportation. And that is regulated in most countries. So we have seen that Uber, for example, is regarded as a taxi. That's not really an option, also because it's quite expensive. But we should think more about forms of shared transportation that really operate as more social transportation, so that people that feel isolated and excluded can still have access to a form of transport.
And it sounds not just to a form of transport, but also to a form of social interaction, almost.
Exactly. Just think of, for example, there's something that I really love that is actually seen also in Amsterdam, the taxis for ladies, the pink taxis, pink cabs. I'm not sure how it's called, but there are a couple of companies of pink cabs, and you have in Asia, you have it quite a lot. And imagine you'd have like a pink van for certain areas where actually, the community could run it, if only for women with children, for example, that would like to go somewhere. This could also be for men. I mean, I'm inclusive. I wouldn't mind about it. But
I'm very glad that I can go as well, Sophia.
Yeah, you can go as well. You're also...
Go ahead.
Everyone is included. This is actually... My idea is not only for... Just for the migrant background. I mean, I don't want to sound biased. I think...
Go on with the idea. I like the idea. Just proceed.
No, more community-driven. But so
more
the community
community-driven.
Is the center.
I mean, nowadays in the Netherlands and also in the UK, you have this new right called the right to challenge, which is more focused on managing public goods. So, for example, a community has a park or a garden, which is really run out, and usually it should be municipality taking care of the garden. The idea of the right to challenge is basically to give some money to the community, and the community will basically take care of the garden as they see fit. Why don't we do that with transportation? I mean, this would go against quite a lot of regulations, but maybe we should flexibilize that a little bit more. And I have written also about innovation-friendly regulation, and that also covers social innovation. So maybe we should really think about community-driven solutions for mobility.
And then the big question comes up to my mind, like, do you use the new technology, like the Uber ones? Do you use it like just for to adapt the city, or do you actually use the new technology for the needs of the people? That's the main question I bump into all the time when I'm talking about this subject.
I think you're also writing about that, Sophia, right? So how can tech actually serve the public interest? How can you arrange that in sort of the legal framework?
Yeah, so I have a paper exactly on this point, on actually the conflict of public and private values when it comes to the platform economy. And in this paper, one of the platforms, or actually one of the companies we analyze, is actually Lime, so the e-scooter service. And Lime, of course, offers Lime or other mobility services. They really offer really good options for citizens or for tourists. But I really wonder who is really using them. I could assume it's probably mostly like highly educated citizens, once again. When you actually look at the public and private interests of this, e-mobility services, you see that there's still quite a lot. We still have a long way to go, because, you know, if you're a company, you want to like basically get the most out of it, profit making. It's normal. It's totally normal. But I don't really think we always have the same interests. I don't think the public interest is always served by these companies. It might be, but I think municipalities have to really negotiate that. They really have to co-regulate more. They have to really tell these mobility companies, look, we want you here. You can help our mobility plans, but you really need to make sure that there are also some scooters in the less fashionable areas of Amsterdam.
How do you think you, as a municipality, policy-wise, you should act on this?
command and control regulation, or top-down regulation, if you will, top-down regulation, is never the best solution because it always means that companies will not be very willing to accept it. So the best way, from my perspective, is really to negotiate the terms, co-regulate if you have to, but just talk to the company and say, look, you want to have e-scooters on the pavement, on the public pavement, fine. But have you thought of also putting some, scooters also in these areas and on those areas? I mean, it's private property. So of course, municipality cannot regulate private property, extensively. But I think it would be good if we see transportation and also micro-mobility as an essential service, then, I mean, there, we can also talk about, making sure that all areas have access to it.
But let's make it super explicit, because we are making this podcast to really also support the municipality in setting this regulation. So you're talking about co-regulation. What is the sort of space that they can use to actually start regulating? Is there any space?
I think when it comes to local public transport, municipalities can still impose some obligations on companies. It just really depends on how you do it. I mean, for example, with bus lines, it's you usually have concessions, which means that one company will basically win the concession. But I think when it comes to micromobility, I don't know. It hasn't really been discussed. I don't actually know exactly how micromobility, whether micromobility has already been regulated by any municipality at local level, for example. I actually don't know. But I can imagine that municipalities could do it because it's basically something that is put on the pavement and you cannot obstruct the public way.
Let's look at it from a different angle, because we're talking about accessibility and then also from a physical and mental disability point of view. So I can imagine that, and there's actually been a paper published on that, Maas and Amstel, which literally describes what is needed for people with mental and physical disability actually engage in sort of normal transport. And it has to do with, for example, different customer interfaces. Not everybody can use the app. They need to go to a call center to be sort of supported in planning their trip. It's also the sort of paratransit. How do we get people from one transport mode to the other, or even into a tram? It's maybe training drivers so they can handle people with special needs. It's about making sure that the data on the availability of all these extra things is known and shared. How can we sort of enforce this, if at all?
I'm so glad you raised that point, because that's something where the Netherlands is still not really taking action. But in UK and in Denmark, there's something called assisted digital. And that is actually a policy which has been introduced to really help people with disabilities, or even the elderly, people that just don't know how to engage with technology, to really be able to use all these apps and be able to even file their taxes online. So assisted digital is really a policy that we should also have here, because this would really make the difference. So assisted digital, if we have a big policy like UK has been attempting to have for some years in Denmark, we could actually make this more visible, and probably, or hopefully, more people would actually be available to actually help those that actually have some accessibility issues.
Can we make it more explicit? If I'm working for the municipality of Amsterdam, then what is it that I should sort of start writing up tomorrow, or I start implementing in the digital domain?
You mentioned the case of logistics, for example. In logistics, everyone knows that most trucks drive half empty, or they drive back empty, and that's a huge problem, also for the environment, right? Mm-hmm. Well, we also have probably data on how many buses or vans from the municipality, from all these companies that work for municipalities, are empty, right? We probably have that data. By using that data, we could also getting data from people that work here at Schiphol or other areas at night, we could actually design an easy, very, very user-friendly application where people could basically say, for example, through Facebook or any social media, which is accessible to everyone, we could actually say, well, we have 50 spots on for tomorrow, like heading Schiphol, for example, at 3 o'clock in the morning. Then we could combine the internet with the infrastructure. We have the infrastructure, we have the data, and then we have to design something which is really user-friendly. And if you do that, you can actually, you don't have to regulate a lot, especially if you actually are just using systems that are out there. So basically, regulation would not be totally in the way. The question is whether you would have permission to use the infrastructure. That is something of which you would have to regulate on a contractual term, I would say. But mm-hmm. you could do that by doing that. But the digital literacy problem has to be solved. And I don't think we can really raise the digital literacy of people so fast. But what we could do is make sure that the application is designed in the easiest way possible, and that we really motivate people to use it.
I think we're going to end this, because otherwise we were going full phase again. I had my first child coming in for the homeschooling already. Yes, good. That happens as well, ladies and gentlemen. That was one of the four ladies coming in. But let's say the last question maybe, or final thought. What did we really miss out? What do you still want to add very briefly, what we missed out so far?
I think it's just important to maybe once again reinforce that, like you, I mean, you just found out you are living in a bubble. Like, even your child coming in for homeschooling, this already shows, like, do you have four ladies, right? Four girls. You probably have four computers at home, but for homeschooling. But imagine all these families that don't have a laptop at home. For those families now with the lockdown, it is impossible to comply with homeschooling. Homeschooling is a great idea, but it's not for everyone. And that also applies to mobility. Mobility as a service is a wonderful idea, but it's still being designed for
this high example
income.
With the computers is so good.
Yeah, let's end on a high note, because we make this series around radical redesign. Let's just imagine what the world would look like if we have complete inclusive mobility.
I know that in Groningen there is a charity that actually offers tickets, train tickets as well, to parents that have financial troubles, so that they can take their kids to the zoo or to Madura Dam, whatever. This charity would not need to exist, because these parents would not have to be burdened with the price of a train ticket to The Hague. And that is, I think, is important. Inclusive mobility would really mean that these parents could just go to the station and using the means of transportation that is the most convenient for them, and they go with as a family to Madura Dam to do what actually a high-income family does, or probably on a more regular basis than they do. And I think that's inclusive mobility. People have to think about how they can get to work or get to a social encounter. And that could mean free transportation. It could mean shared transportation, subsidies for transportation, or basically from a legal perspective, it could mean just that we see transportation as something just as important as water, electricity, or gas. And that means that, you know, it might not be for free, because gas, food, and that's not for free. But the thing is, we regulate it to make sure that everyone has access, universal access. And I think it's what inclusive mobility is.
Yeah, for now, thank you very, very much for your time, Sophia. It was great to have you on the show and that you shared all your views. In the show notes, we will have your website and essays all in. And maybe, Karin, also to say from our side, we always hope for good reviews. And you can subscribe to this podcast for free if you want to. In your app, then you get the next episode automatically. But maybe, for instance, also say what's the goal of the making this whole series, and what would you hope that will happen?
Yeah, so I would love for this series of podcasts to really turn into sort of a bigger conversation, because we have really in-depth, intimate conversations, sometimes even at kitchen tables with all these visionaries. And we try to ask the right questions and to really sort of dig deep. But I know there's so many people out there that have answers or better questions or can contribute. So I hope they listen to this podcast and actually respond in whatever way, shape or form. So through reviews, through subscriptions, or by emailing us directly.
And what my goal will be that they actually share it to other people, and you can actually hear what the experts say, and you can agree or disagree, it doesn't matter, but you can actually be part of the conversation instead of looking at a report or instead of looking at a PowerPoint from a consultant and you haven't got a clue. So thank you very much. Bye-bye and cheerio.